Thank you. Well, thank you for that warm welcome. And I have to say, I'm flattered to be the first 500 champion here would be an understatement. I have to believe that that's been an oversight that wasn't intentional, but I'm glad to be here and glad to be with all of you. And I think a little bit of today's audience, I'm preaching to the choir perhaps, which always makes it more comfortable, because there's a lot of people from my alma mater, Denison University, here, from my dealership group. That's self-applause there, you might add. For those who are listening and don't know where that came from. But it is great being here with you. I was reminded this morning what a beautiful city this is. I went out for my morning run and ran past the Vietnam Memorial and up the mall, and what a fantastic city. I think it was only several years ago that Tony and I had the chance to meet with President Bush. We came here to celebrate our win in the 2004 Indy 500 with Buddy Rice. Of course, he drove for our team. And it was always a very heady experience to go to the White House, believe me. And for those of you who haven't been there, and so to come back and sort of be reminded of that was very special. Now, it may come as somewhat of a shock to all of you, but I'm not a regular viewer of C-SPAN, so my apologies. But as a history major in college, I have watched at times with great interest a veritable who's who of presidents, prime ministers, ambassadors, senators, congressmen, you name it, in front of those cameras. And though my comments today may not have the life or death import that perhaps their comments have had over time, I do think that there's a story to tell, and I hope you find it as compelling as I. I am truly humbled to be here, particularly being the first race car Indy 500 champion. I should be more specific. And I have to say, even after several decades of racing at 200 miles an hour, inches apart, I really now know what the hot seat is all about. I believe I've been really blessed in my chosen profession. I went through 25 years of motor racing pretty much without a scratch. And I'm reminded, when I think back, I'm reminded of a quote by Bob Dylan that sums it up for me, where he said, in quote, "A person is a success if they get up in the morning and get to bed at night and in between does what he wants to do." And I was very much able to do that and continue to do so today. Not just thanks to my own efforts, but thanks to all the people that I was involved with all those years that helped me on my quest. My family, my partners, all the mechanics, the engineers, the sponsors, you name it, that commit their resource to any race car driver so that he can be successful. My competitive fires in both the business world and in the sport were really stoked by my father. He was a first-generation immigrant. I grew up in a very much an entrepreneurial environment. He was busy trading commodities such as fruit juice concentrates in Chicago, where I was raised. And his hobby was racing sports cars, like millions of people do every weekend in this country. And of course, as a young man, an impressionable young man, I was happy to tag along, and I soaked up everything. In fact, I think he always rued introducing me to racing, because when I was a child or a young man, I think I knew the latest road and track far better than I knew my math homework. And of course, in my family, my name wasn't Unser or Andretti, it was Rahal, and there was no really predisposed idea that you would become a race car driver. The idea was you would get a job, and then if you raced, you did it as a hobby. I attended Denison, as I said earlier, graduated with a degree in history, and I will personally recognize all my fellow alums. It's a wonderful university, and I'm pleased that my youngest son just got accepted there. However, I have to admit, as some might know, that I missed my college graduation in 1975 to enter my first professional race, and thankfully my parents somehow agreed with that. Poetically now, it seems my son Graham is following in my footsteps. He's racing, doing a fantastic job at 18 years of age. He skipped his high school prom last weekend to finish second in the Houston Grand Prix, although I have to admit he was smart enough to bring his girlfriend with him. I'm proud to report, as I said, that at 18 years and 3 months of age, Graham became the youngest driver in Champ Car history to finish on the podium. taking the checkered flag, second place, as I mentioned. Now, there's an irony to everything, and I'm not sure that, while I love to see him do as well as he's doing, I'm not sure I like to be referred to as Graham Rahal's dad. Ernest Hemingway once said that auto racing, bullfighting, and mountain climbing are the only real sports, and everything else are games. And I don't know if I completely agree with him, but it's certainly a ringing endorsement of our sport, as well as a tribute to all those mountain climbers and bullfighters in the audience today. The racing landscape has changed dramatically in the 25 years since I've been involved. Not only has the sport grown in leaps and bounds in terms of its popularity, but it has really become a technological proving ground. As was mentioned before, we have 14, the technology of it, we have 14 full-time degreed engineers on our staff. They are the best and the brightest. And in the IndyCar series, the difference between first and second literally can be measured in thousandths of a second. It's the behind the series, below the tip of the iceberg, the technology, which is the real critical component of our performance at the track. On any given race weekend, our team employs a full range of laptops, PCs, wireless technologies to ensure top performance from our race cars. While the cars are on track, transmitters send a continual stream of information to receivers in each team's pit, keeping all of us fully informed about the vital signs of the racing car at speed. The information is often encrypted so that no one else can access our information. It is further evidence that racing has become more and more a science in today's sports world. As an aside, and I was happy to see some of the folks from the SAE, Society of Automotive Engineers, as an aside, all of our engineers, graduates of some of the finest universities in the country, participated in the Formula SAE program, a university-inspired program using college-level motorsports to teach engineering students the lessons of vehicle dynamics in a competitive environment. I believe virtually every young engineering student today who aspires to design and develop automobiles in this country has had or will have some kind of involvement at some point in time with the Formula SAE program. For those of you in the press, I encourage you to research the Formula SAE program to learn more. The IndyCar Series, the Indy Racing League, is a leading open-wheel racing series in the United States. The league and its crown jewel, the Indianapolis 500, has long had a tradition of technical and safety innovations. Many of these innovations gradually work their way down to our everyday streetcars. As was mentioned earlier, in 1911, the first rearview mirror was brought into being. In the 1960s, well before any other racing series, the fuel cell was developed to minimize the threat of fire in an accident. In the 60s as well, the jet turbine car was introduced, as was turbocharging small displacement engines in the 1970s. In the 1980s, the development of the automotive equivalent of the black box was finalized, and for the first time, designers could engineer cars with complete knowledge of the dynamics of a crash and how to mitigate them. Today, under the leadership of Tony, all 12 tracks in the 2007 IRL IndyCar Series have the Safer barrier installed on all four turns of each track. Safer stands for Steel and Energy Foam Reduction. It is clearly one of the most effective safety measures today in the racing industry, designed to reduce the severity of impacts by cars and, of course, again, minimizing the physical risk to those who drive them. And living up to its hallmark as a technological leader in worldwide motorsports, 2007 will again introduce further technological advancement. It's May, and in motor racing world, May means one thing, the Indy 500. And on May 27th, later this month, before a worldwide audience of over 300 million people, the familiar announcement, ladies and gentlemen, start your engines, will be music to the ears of many racing fans. The Indy 500 is the greatest spectacle in racing, and it once again features experienced drivers in high-tech vehicles competing at speeds of up to 220 miles an hour, inches apart. For those of us who love racing, it really doesn't get any better than that. But this year's race is also a tribute to the spirit of American ingenuity and innovation. Ethanol is sharing the track with a great American pastime, the Indy 500. And for the first time in history, a renewable fuel will power a vehicle past the checkered flag at the race, which is a tribute to many in the racing industry and in farmlands across this great country. This is groundbreaking technological achievement in the racing community and in the world of the automobile. The use of 100% fuel-grade ethanol makes the IndyCar series the first in motorsports anywhere in the world to embrace a renewable and environmentally friendly fuel source. The series really is now at the forefront of the greening of racing. And if you read, if you follow the world of motorsports, whether it's Formula One, whether it's the American Le Mans series, IndyCar racing, what have you, if you read about the manufacturers, it is the use of alternative fuels in the future that is gaining the most influence within those organizations. The unique partnership between the ethanol industry and the IndyCar series has advanced from ethanol being a team sponsor, which they are with us, to working with the series to introduce an ethanol-methanol blend in 2006, and to today, 100% ethanol. This is the first time in 40 years that a new fuel source has been incorporated into open-wheel racing. Despite the obvious environmental and economic benefits of ethanol, our engineers had to be convinced, of course, like all engineers, that in the performance department there would be no difference. Pure ethanol has an octane rating of 113, and as a result, our drivers are demonstrating under extremely harsh conditions that performance and environment can responsibly coexist. Throughout my life, racing has been a quest for speed and performance. The quest for a competitive advantage is obviously often tied to horsepower, aerodynamics, and fuel strategies. And yet I stand before you today espousing the virtues of a renewable fuel that can significantly impact our environmental concerns and our dependence on foreign oil. Although these issues were not a high priority during my racing career, times have changed for all of us. I am proud to share the track with a cleaner burning renewable fuel cultivated in the fields of the United States that holds promise for our country's energy future. For more than 30 years, the American consumer has been powerless as we've endured one energy crisis after the other. The key words during these times were ration, conserve, sacrifice. And as the debate raged, motor racing continued on its merry way. Motorsports has always been seen as irresponsible to somehow to those words. Now, using the ideals that have made this country great, ingenuity and grit, we are challenging that status quo. Unlike other fuel alternatives that are years in the making, such as hydrogen, such as fuel cell, such as battery, electric, you name it, ethanol is available now. It is a key element in our drive for energy independence, and for those of us who participate in the world of motorsports, it's our element for survival in the future. Although we've been pleased with the performance aspect of ethanol in the IndyCar series, our pit crews are breathing easier, I'm told. Our previous fuel methanol, which was petroleum-based, was tough on the eyes and nose. Some of our crew with ethanol have reported that it smells like nothing other than popcorn. Now, I don't know about that. But I do know that the ethanol movement has empowered our country across, or our people across the nation. These communities in the farmlands are now flexing their economic muscle with a keen eye to the future, that the impact of ethanol goes far beyond mere dollars and cents. It has enabled these towns to grow and to maintain a sense of tradition and cohesiveness that was under threat. No longer, I guess you could say, is the grass greener on the other side of the hill. This is a golden moment, and this is what excites me most about what's going on today in 2007. Because motorsports, for the first time in a long time, has relevancy to our everyday life. It is simply just not entertainment anymore. The message to consumers is a powerful one that we represent in our, with our racing team and with the series. If a 675 horsepower Indy car can run safely and effectively at 220 miles an hour, with either a mix of E10 or with flex fuel vehicles of E85, then just imagine what it can do for your car. Our racing team also runs a Porsche in the American Le Mans series. I began racing in my racing career in the sports car series. As I said earlier, winning the 12 Hours of Sebring in 1987. The American Le Mans series is now the first in motorsports to run a street legal blend of ethanol enriched with E10 in their vehicles, which is no different than what you can buy at your gas station on every corner. What makes this special is that the fuel switch showcases to consumers in cars that they recognize that such premier brands as Porsche, Acura, BMW, Ferrari, and others can compete at high speed utilizing a fuel that's available, as I said, just around the corner. I won the Indianapolis 500 in 1986, and as anybody will tell you who's ever won one of them, so many things can happen. Just getting to the end is a feat in itself. It's difficult to comprehend what winning that race does to you in your career, but I can tell you it stays with you and defines you for the rest of your career. As you become older, you realize that really you go beyond just being a winner to being a caretaker of a great tradition. I won as a driver in 86, as I said, and I won as a team owner, co-team owner with my partner David Letterman in 2004. Many people ask me the difference between being a driver and an owner. As a driver, there was a great sense of achievement. As an owner, I think it's even more so because you truly understand what goes into winning on any given day. So in the end, I simply answer that each is different. One's an apple and one's an orange, and they're equally as thrilling. Now, in my early 30s, as I started to enjoy some financial success, I knew racing wasn't going to be forever, that at one point in time I'd have to grow up and get a real job. Many athletes don't want to admit when it's time to hang up the cleats or put away the racing helmet or what have you. It's a difficult decision, believe me. But what really struck me over the years is that you go to every race and you see all the well-wishers and the backslappers and the people who are hoping for you and praying for you, and you become connected with all these people. The roar of the crowd is a powerful narcotic, I can assure you. But I wanted to make sure that I had as much control over the rest of my life as possible, and so in one way was to own my own team with my partner David Letterman, and in another way was to create another business, which was based on the retail automotive business. We started pretty humbly in 1989, being a Honda dealer in outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. When we started, we thought that would be it. We never had any idea that it would grow beyond that. I think our first Christmas party, we had 25 people, and that included spouses, girlfriends, you name it. Now we have 13 franchises and over 800 employees, and I'm constantly asking if that person works for us or the other person. Christmas parties, it's a double-edged sword nowadays, but it's a lot of fun. I would like to recognize and ask them to stand, if I may. I don't know if that's correct, but if I would, my partners in my automobile dealerships who are here today from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I am most proud of them and what we've achieved over the years because, as I said, we started out very, very humbly, and here we are today. I tell you this because one of the most critical things that I took away from racing is that nothing is forever. That there's a fragility to everything that we do in our life, whether it's as a sport or as a business or just in the relationships that we have. As they say, life comes at you fast, and in my case, it was faster than most, I suppose. But the one thing that we came away from those 25 years was that we never assumed tomorrow would be the same as today, that we all always had to work hard to make sure tomorrow was better. A setback can often be an opportunity to learn and to grow, and I think that's what we've striven to do over the years. The IndyCar Series teams are truly American businesses. As I indicated to you earlier, with all the technology and the strategies employed by that you see in more traditional firms, they're echoed in our firm. Its drivers and teams are as much a part of the business life and the business landscape as bigger institutions housed in skyscrapers and office buildings. And its new developments, such as the use of ethanol, are as thrilling in our industry as a new product placed on the shelf for consumers. In short, we too are part of the great story of America, and we are proud to be, and we are proud of that fact. And thank you very much. I look forward to your questions.
Okay, our first question is, not to use a pun, but what was the driving force behind this switch to ethanol? Were you trying to help advance alternative fuel technologies, spread the popularity of ethanol, or are you trying to find a marketing angle to compete with NASCAR?
that last part of that question. With all due to respect to my friends at NASCAR, I have many, who just announced recently, in the last month or so, that they were converting to unleaded fuel. Some 30 years after the fact where most racing converted. I do believe that I'm sure I'll get letters for that. I do believe, with all sincerity, that motor racing has to provide value. And value isn't just entertainment-based. It's based on its responsibility and what it can provide the industry as a whole. And that's what I said earlier. What makes me so excited about this is the relevancy that we now have to the automotive marketplace that hasn't existed for some time. Dating way back to the rearview mirror and beyond, as I mentioned earlier, the turbocharging, things of that nature that really had value down the line has contributed to the automotive industry. That's happening now. And, of course, there's always misgivings in people's minds about anything that seems a radical change, given the nature of the world as we face it today, and given the fact that alternative fuel is important, vitally so now. What I'm most pleased about is certainly we love being involved with the industry as a whole. Yes, they're our sponsor, but I think that it the story it tells is legitimate and credible. And there's no question, as I said earlier in my speech, if you read the industry press in our industry, in Formula One, if you read where Honda's going, where all the manufacturers go, GM with their real commitment to E85, they're not doing this because it's just something to do. They're doing this because that is the future. Alternative fuels is the future. And motor racing now has its rightful place to really put momentum behind the development of that. We're seeing it in the ALMS, as I said, the American Le Mans Series. It's already in the IRL and IndyCar Series. And you're going to see in Formula One in the next year or two, I think you're going to start to see alternative fuels being used there. Already, Le Mans, the greatest sports car race in history and in the world. A diesel-powered car won last year. And you're going to continue to see those kinds of developments. So certainly, as I said, yes, we love being involved with ethanol. They're a great group of organizations, because really it's a mass of organizations involved, but the story is credible and legitimate and has every right to be there.
What were the primary concerns that you all had about making the switch to ethanol? Does ethanol lower gas mileage, and does it impact how fast the cars can go?
It does not impact how fast cars can go. Fuel mileage, of course, as everybody knows, is less than that of gasoline. Of course, in racing, we're not so concerned about that now, but we look at those as temporary hurdles. And I think over time, the technologies, which are already being advanced as we speak, will be in place to ensure that things like fuel consumption or what have you are similar to gasoline or the things that we're normally used to.
So has the switch had any impact on the dynamics of the race?
Absolutely not. I think the racing is still separated by thousandths of a second. It should have no impact one way or the other. It doesn't make it better. It doesn't make it worse. It's really the same.
If race cars typically get less than 2 miles per gallon, wouldn't the greenest thing be to not have a race at all?
That's obviously sent in by somebody who doesn't like racing. I don't think so. There's still, aside from the relevancy, the idea of entertainment is still obviously valid. And the day there were two automobiles built in 1898 or whenever it happened, that's when racing started. And as long as there's more than one vehicle out there, there will always be racing. But the fact of the matter is that the technologies that we see employed in this series, whether it's engine technologies, the fuel technologies, aerodynamic technologies, that's all going to come down line. And it's already had, a productive impact on the industry as a whole, and it's going to continue. And another way that motorsports provides relevancy is by the training of the engineers and by the relationships that the manufacturers have. If you take a company like Honda, which puts great faith in motorsports as a way to teach their young engineers the necessity of actually producing something in a very tight time constraint. That's a mentality that they then transfer to when they go back to to Marysville, Ohio, or the R&D centers, or wherever they go, and they take the lessons learned from motorsports and apply them to their everyday automobile manufacturing business. And as I said earlier, Formula SAE, same thing, same idea. So I think there's a lot of value aside that motor racing provides, but clearly the ethanol story, the alternative fuel story, is a big one right now.
Aside from what the Indy 500 is doing, what should car manufacturers do to encourage the use of alternative fuels in people's everyday car use? And since we're in Washington, any thoughts on what you would like Congress and the President to do in terms of raising fuel efficiency standards or increasing subsidies for research into ethanol or anything else?
Well, that's I don't know if I want to get into the political aspects of that, because being in the automobile business, we understand that there's a lot of pressure on the automobile manufacturers to improve fuel mileage. Many of the brands that we represent have been at the forefront of that, whether there's been a political push for it or not, much of which has stemmed from the fuel crisis in 73, 74. So it's always been happening anyway in a large respect. And, of course, if we really want to get political, it was the government that set the CAFE standards, the numbers associated with that, which now turn out not to be quite correct, or they want to change those and move the bar, so to speak. But the reality is that I think that the automobile industry understands the challenges that face it. And the biggest challenge it faces is how can it become a responsible community of the world. And alternative fuel, as I said earlier, that's the answer. The technology, the investment that's going into it is huge. Probably never been bigger in the history of the automobile. And so I think it's happening anyway. Of course, subsidies are, especially on the R&D side, are always important, because R&D, we know it from our racing team, we know it from as being an automobile manufacturer, that out of research and development, all good things come. And yet it's very, very expensive to do that. So that kind of support is critical in order for us to meet these new standards or to improve the responsibility of the automobile as part of our everyday lives.
Several people want to know about your own cars, what kind of cars they are, what fuels them, and are you doing other things in your personal life to be more green and environmentally conscious?
Well, the cars I drive are, as an automobile dealer, you might imagine I get to drive a few, as my partners will tell you. Many of my cars are kind of older. Frankly, I'm currently running a Range Rover, which probably doesn't get the best fuel mileage in the world. But we sell them, and we drive what we sell. Of course, it uses 10% ethanol as it is, so there is a value to it from that regard. But certainly, over the years, driven Hondas, Toyotas, you name it, and I think they've been leading the industry in terms of their fuel mileage capabilities. And of course, everybody understands that we have a responsibility to our communities in terms of everyday life. So I don't pretend I'm not a Sierra Club member, but I think I'm pretty pleased with the way I go about my life.
Do you know what the carbon footprint is for the Indy 500? And besides the switch to ethanol, are there other things that the car series is doing to be more environmentally conscious?
I knew that question would come up. I don't know what the carbon footprint is of the Indy 500, but being the fact that that it's all biofuel based, I would say it's relatively nominal, given all things considered. This is historic, and while it may not be, it's not the end of the line by any means. It's the beginning, and already, and I think Tony might correct me, but already there is a race being talked about, which would be hydrogen powered. In about the year 2011, I believe, at Indianapolis. I think I read it was at Indianapolis, and Tony could perhaps elaborate. But that's what racing can provide, and that's as exciting to me as anything else. So So while I don't know the impact of it as it exists today, it's certainly far less than it was 2 years ago, and it's just going to get better.
A couple of people have questions about your career, looking back on your career. They want to know, what was the most fun you ever had in a race car? And someone asks, some of the best racing in America was in a Formula Atlantic in the mid-70s. What are your fondest recollections of that era?
Well, the most fun I had in a race car was when I won, as you might imagine. That's always fun. Anything after that or anything beside or beyond that, it wasn't much fun. Somebody said, what was the most comfortable lap I ever had in Indianapolis, and I said it was the fastest lap I ever did in Indianapolis, and I said some of the most uncomfortable laps I ever had were the slowest laps. And of course, for the general public, that's a little, that concept, those concepts are a little hard to understand. But when a race car is right, you feel like you can do anything, and when it isn't, you feel like you can't do a thing. So that's always, and I don't mean to be glib about it, but obviously when you won a race, the sense of satisfaction for yourself as a driver and for your team and everybody involved was tremendous. And frankly, there's far more lows in racing than there are highs. Those wins, I think I won about 24 races out of 200 IndyCar races, so a little more than 10%. So there were a lot of times when I didn't win, but those 24 sort of made up for all those days I didn't. And that keeps you going. As far as that series, the Atlantic series, in 1975, we were all young, and we all wanted to rule the world, and there were a lot of good guys at the time. One of the greats, Gilles Villeneuve, who, Canadian driver, Formula One driver, was probably one of the most gifted race car drivers in history. He and I raced against each other in those days, and it was fun. It was very, very competitive, and as I said, we all had grand plans and great designs on where we were going to go, and some of us made it, some of us didn't, but it was a great time.
What does it take to be a successful race car driver, and can you obsess, objectively, of course, your son's future?
I hope it's good. But as far as what does it take, it takes luck. It takes discipline, takes commitment, it takes dedication. I think if you talk to any sports figure, it would, all the same tenets, all the same beliefs, they would be the same. Although I think in motorsports, because the price of the car and everything is a lot more than a set of golf clubs or a basketball, you definitely have to become as much of a businessman as you are a driver. I think that in the end, what really makes a difference, and a lot of people think that this, race car drivers aren't very smart, at least that's been the traditional, I think, sense, is that the smartest guys, they may not have a formal education per se, but the smartest guys won every time. Guys like Mario Andretti, A.J. Foyt, Rick Mears, people like that, the Unsers, they may not have gone to college, they may not have a degree, but they were innately intelligent people that could take in everything that was coming at them as fast as it was coming at them and make the proper decisions at the right time. And so I think that made the big difference. That makes a difference in anything. There are a lot of talented people, but talent isn't the only element that defines success. And in fact, I've always said, give me a driver who doesn't have quite the same level of talent, but he's got a commitment to excellence in how he lives his life and his, he trains and how he eats and how he prepares himself. I'll take that guy anytime, because he may not win, one race or two or six races, but he'll be there every day of the week, and that's what you really want. So in regards to my son at 18 years old, all I can say is the sky is the limit. And, there's nothing worse than racetrack fathers. I've had to deal with them over the years. So my commitment is to not be one. So I stand as far away as I can, chew my fingernails and pray, but it's fun to watch, and I think he's got a great future, and we'll just see how far he goes.
We just talked about your son. Would you encourage your daughters to race, and what do you see as the future of women in car racing?
Well, I encourage if you've seen my daughters drive, no, I wouldn't encourage them that. That's definitely one thing I would not do. But, I'd like to take some credit for Danica Patrick, even though she doesn't drive for us anymore. But there's no question that women can be successful in racing. There's a lot of women who are racing. There's a lot more that are in the pipeline, so to speak, that are coming up through karting and other types of the lower level racing, trying to get to the top. This year at Indy, we'll have three women in the race, which is by far more than any other series has ever had at any given time. They can be, you know, Danica. We almost won Indianapolis in 2005 with her, and so it's possible, and it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. So I think Lynn St. James, who was really one of the pioneers for women in motorsports, said when I get in the car doesn't know what gender I am, and that's very, very true. So it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when.
How big a loss to your team was the departure of Danica?
Well, obviously, I was disappointed that she decided to leave. But you know, if a person doesn't want to be there, then they have to, you know, they have to go and do their own thing. And we were disappointed, and we wish her all the luck. But life goes on, and now our job's to beat her.
This is a question for Tony George, if he'll answer it. A couple people wanted to know what it's going to take to bring the IRL and Champ Cars together into a World Series.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate Bobby for the honor of being the first Indianapolis 500 champion to address this luncheon, and for his stewardship and ambassadorship that he's provided to our sport and to our business. And as you can tell by his remarks today, he's very eloquent and very committed and very passionate. I wish I knew the answer to that question, because it's asked of me all the time, and the simple fact of the matter is I don't know. I think that open-wheel racing, for as long as it's been around, has had controversy, has had different organizations and leadership, and you know, everyone thinks they have the answer or the right answer to what's best, and at any given time, people tend to lean one way or another with one organization or one individual's thinking on that. I know I have the Indianapolis Motor Speedway's best interest in mind and at heart in the decisions I make as they pertain to the Speedway, the Indy Racing League, which was founded on the history and tradition of the Indianapolis 500, and the experience that I believe I've learned and earned over, you know, the past 47 years, having been born into the family that had it as part of its family enterprise, and had helped revive and breathe new life into the Indianapolis 500. And my parents were drivers and car owners and whatnot. My son, like Bobby's, is a race car driver and will compete in the Indianapolis 500 next month or this month. So, you know, these are all things that are important to me. It's part of our family. The institution is part of our family, part of our DNA. And everybody's got a different opinion about, you know, where they would like to see a sport go at any given time. And right now, I think that Champ Car and the Indy Racing League, while not on completely divergent paths, are still separated, and I think that there's a lot of things that go into it. It's not as simple as saying, you know, I wish I could wave my magic wand and bring the two together, but I think in time, you know, I think as we sit back and look at it, that we'll see opportunities to come together, and I think that would be probably good for open-wheel racing, but I have no idea what the timeline might be.
One related question, do you ever see NASCAR merging with Indy Racing?
That probably has a lesser chance of happening than the two open wheel series, but again, it gets back to different philosophies. I think, as Bobby mentioned, you know, NASCAR focuses on entertainment and business. I've always felt that, you know, it's a delicate balance between sport, entertainment, competition, technology, You know, all those things are important, but it's finding the right balance of each to really, it's the key to success. And, you know, I think some of the comments that Tony Stewart made recently about likening NASCAR to or World Wrestling, I don't think that's the case. And but I do think that they factor in certain elements and give them more weight than others.
Some more team questions for you. Do you have any good David Letterman stories, and how active an owner is he?
Not really, or at least if I did, I'm sure I couldn't tell anybody about him. Just that we made a deal long ago that I wouldn't do a talk show and he wouldn't drive a racing car. But he is very active, obviously not on an hourly basis or even maybe a daily basis, but he's, number one, he's very, very knowledgeable about the sport. Number two, he's very concerned about what's going on, and so we talk regularly. He talks with my COO about it as well. They're both from Indiana, so that's a common thread there, I think, to some extent. But he is very keen, and naturally he's got a pretty demanding job as it is, which prevents him from perhaps being more involved than he is at this time. But he is there, and he's very knowledgeable, as I said, and he's been a great partner all along because he knows what's going on, and that's always a huge plus, obviously.
What are you doing to try to develop young drivers who can have a strong public appeal?
Well, I mean, I guess the last person that I tried to develop was Danica, and I think we got her a lot of the way there. I've always been very interested in the development of young drivers because we were all a young driver at one time. I remember when I was, my career early on was sort of ups and downs. It wasn't this nice, smooth ascension. And you really realize at the time that there are key, every driver needs a champion, somebody who really believes in him or her, somebody who's ready to support them. Mine was Jim Truman, who started the Red Roof Inn hotel chain, who tragically passed away from cancer literally about a week after we won Indy in 1986. But without Jim Truman, there was just no way. I don't know what I'd be doing, but I certainly wouldn't be here. I'm sure of that. So every young driver needs that support, that champion for them. And I've always been interested in that and tried to give constructive advice to young guys who do come up. And there's a lot of them. There's a lot of young people trying to make the grade. And it's very, very tough in motor racing to do that. There's very few places available. And you're competing, it's a world market. You're competing against people from all over the world. So that makes it even more difficult to make that grade. I just try to give them good advice and to really instill in them the idea that it's more than just driving, that they have to be businessmen, that they have to understand that the way they carry themselves as a man is important, or a woman in this case, is important, how they're perceived, that may not be fair. But being so corporately based as racing is, corporations want to be aligned with winners. They want that person to be a mirror image of how they see themselves. And so you better understand that and accept that. That's not always the case. But that's the way the world is today in motor. It has been for quite some time. And so I try the advice I try to give is really more off track than it is on track, because I can't tell somebody how to drive a race car. You either have it or you don't, in my estimation. But I can tell them, as I say for my son, I can tell them where all the landmines are buried. You know, I can tell them the challenges, and most of that is off-track based. So that's the value I can contribute, and I'm always happy to do so.
What has NASCAR done better than the Indy Racing League that allowed them to become more popular?
Well, I think you have to go back. For many years, NASCAR was sponsored by a highly regulated consumer product, tobacco, who couldn't advertise on TV, who couldn't advertise in a lot of places, and who generated tremendous cash flow. And the best way for them to get on TV, the best way for them to raise their consciousness was to get involved with a sport that was televised. So what was once called the Grand National Series became the Winston Cup. And the and R.J. Reynolds actually had a production company or a marketing company whose sole job was to grow their involvement in sports car racing. Camel Cigarettes was involved with sports car racing for many years, but particularly Winston with NASCAR. And they did a tremendous job. They had tremendous sums, tremendous funds to be able to do it, but they still did a tremendous job on top of it. Open wheel racing was sponsored during that time by a non-consumer, non-regulated product, PPG Paints. And their client was a body shop owner, the guy who was, you know, going to buy somebody's paint to paint cars. And PPG wanted to connect with that audience. So, and as a result, obviously, far less funds to develop, to devote to marketing programs and what have you. There's just no question that was the difference. And it's still resting on that to some degree, although now we see even NASCAR. Nothing's forever, and even NASCAR now is suffering. Their ratings have been down for the last several 2 years in particular. Their attendances are down at the events. So even it's starting to that momentum has slowed up for them. But I think that was the big cause. It was just purely promotion. Certainly there was an attachment that people had. But, you know, in the 1980s, NASCAR was basically a southeastern sport. And in the 90s, it grew into a national sport. And much of that was done with the assistance of the tobacco companies. So that's a big reason, I think.
Where do you see the future of open wheel racing 10 to 20 years from now? What will the cars be like, and what will the competition be like?
Well, the competition will be fierce. I have no idea what the cars will look like. If I could look accurately into the future, I think I'd be doing something else right now. But it will be here, and it'll be, as I said, it will become even more, I think, it has to become more relevant and more responsible to what's going on in the real world. It always has been, but it's going to become even more so, I think, because I think it's going to have to. Racing as a whole is going to have to, or it won't exist. Because the future, if we look into it, it's, I think, pretty difficult. And there's a lot of reasons in my mind to, if we assume it's a status quo, it's not going to be a very nice status quo in the future. And so it's going to be up to us in our business, in the automotive industry, to really go to the next level and to help form that future. And I think that's happening, and racing will be in step with that all the way.
You've been called one of the genuinely nice people in this sport. Who are the not-so-nice people?
Well, if I answered that, I wouldn't be one of the nice people, would I? I think that's a question that's better left unsaid or unanswered. There's a lot of good people, though.
Let me try it a different way. What are David Letterman's top 10 lists of things we should know about you and maybe on the not-so-nice side?
Oh, well, you know, it's like I never thought I should promote myself or talk about myself one way or the other. I guess I think I'll stay true to that.
In your life as an auto dealer, what do you see as the biggest problem for auto dealers in the next few years?
Being profitable, wouldn't that be it, guys? It's a very challenging business. The automobile industry, I think, is the only industry where the consumer knows exactly what that product costs the dealer to buy, and therefore knows what the profit margin is into it. The thing that makes the differences in how dealers do make money is they provide a level of service and commitment to that customer that is second to none. We were in Pittsburgh. We have a BMW dealership there. We won a Center of Excellence Award. There's 338 BMW dealers in the country. 31 won that award, so less than 10%. And we were one of those 31 and the only one in the state of Pennsylvania. And that comes from one thing. That comes from world-class service and a commitment to our customers to be there, rain or shine. And that's not easy to do. And there's a tremendous investment that on our part that comes with that. But that, when in the automobile industry in particular, but like I think in any consumer-based industry, if you rely on price to determine the winner, you're never going to win. What determines the winner as a company is the the subjective side, the treatment, the customer service that you provide, the idea that if things aren't going well, you're there, the way you treat people, that's what makes the difference. And that's just going to become more of an issue as time goes on because people's expectations continue to go up. And the automobile industry is changing. At times, the automobile manufacturers have even toyed with the idea that you would be able to buy the car directly from them and you know, sidestep the dealership. Well, that's great, but when you have a problem and there's no dealers there to help you, are you going to go to the manufacturer? Well, obviously not. So the automobile dealer network, which is shrinking, actually, there's fewer dealers today than there were 2 years ago. There's a consolidation going on with publicly held automobile dealership groups, but there's also consolidation with privately held groups. It's just raising the bar, and it's the best time to be in the market for a car because, number one, there isn't a bad car out there anymore, really, and number two, the level of service that is expected has never been so high, and it's just going to continue, in my estimation. So the challenges are great. But the consumer has to understand that if they want that service, there is a price to pay for that, that it doesn't happen, you know, for nothing, that there's a commitment, there's an investment. It just as a real quick aside, I remember one time this fellow, we have a Lexus dealership, and this fellow was sort of complaining about the price that we offered him, and he was a radiologist. And I took him aside, and I said, you know, it's amazing. I asked him where he went to school, and I said, you know, I just had an X-ray done not too long ago, and I got a bill for $200. And I said, but that film couldn't have cost more than 50 cents. And as I started, well, but I understand you went to college for 12 years. I understand you have a staff. I understand you have malpractice insurance. And I got about halfway through that list, and he said, enough said. You know, because the reality is there is so much that goes into it to open your doors. And that is the challenge that I think what we face as automobile dealers.
Now, for the last question, members of the press are nothing if not skeptical, and somebody wants to know, besides this speech, how will fans really know that your car is using ethanol on Indy 500 day?
How will they know? Because we let the world know. And we tell the truth. We're going to be using ethanol, and proudly so.